On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doug Kirby.
We are delighted to welcome back to On the Bookshelf one of my favorite guests, William Hazelgrove, national best-selling author and historian whose books have included Wright Brothers, Wrong Story, How Wilbur Wright Solved the Problem of Man Flight, Madam President, The Secret Presidency of Edith Wilson, Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt, and Al Capone and the 1933 World's Fairs. And we talked to Will about all of these books, and we're here to get a chance to talk with his new about his new book, 160 Minutes, The Race to Save the RMS Titanic. It's from Prometheus Books, an imprint of Roman and Littlefield Publishing Group. Will, thanks so much for joining us again on the bookshelf today.
No, thanks for having me.
I got to say that the book is written as a very gripping narrative. We are very aware of time and the significance of how much time is left at every point through the book, which makes it really exciting. And yet this is not just a story. This is a genuine story and a genuine tragedy. So it just makes for a great read.
Yeah, I mean, for your listeners, 160 minutes. The reason I called it the book that was, you know, from the moment it struck the iceberg, Titanic only had 2 hours and 40 minutes to stay afloat. And so the race was on, essentially. And I thought, when I was thinking about writing the book, I thought, you know, I'm going to bookend it with this 160 minutes and just count it down as everybody scrambles to try and rescue the Titanic. And I think that's been overlooked, the rescue mission, because there was a vast rescue mission to try and get to this ship before it sank and save those 1,500 people who would ultimately die in the North Atlantic.
The book brings forth a couple of new heroes and a couple of new semi-villains, and also shows the frailties of many of the people that we have thought of as these nobly heroic people who all stood by and waved at their wives and children as they all set sail in nice filled lifeboats. This is absolutely incorrect.
Yeah, there's a lot of mythology around Titanic, and it sort of began with Walter Lord's book, A Night to Remember, in 1959. Lord's book is not wrong. It's just he decided to interview the survivors, and his book's only 112 pages. And so, you know, it's sort of a you are there, but that sort of set the floor for all Titanic books to come. And the mythology even began before that, when the newspapers didn't have all the information, and so they had to create a story. And so the story they created was sort of this great heroic story, a Titanic out there in the North Atlantic all alone in the darkness, and that there was no way she could escape her fate. And so this puts the tragedy into epic land. And, you know, the fact that her fate was preordained, and the best we could do was, you know, send off the wives and children and, you know, have a shot of brandy and a cigar and sayonara, you know. But the truth of Titanic is one of, really, and it's sort of shocking to say it, even though it's the thesis of my book, but really everyone could have been saved.
Yeah, that, to me, that was the most terrible truth that I learned from reading your book, that there were two ship captains that had the chance, that were close, and could have pulled everybody out of the water and chose not to, and that all these half-empty lifeboats could have turned around and gone back out and picked up people that were floating around freezing to death in the water, and they didn't. So there's really two sets of villainy. It seems harsh, but I guess if you'd been in the ice, you would have certainly seen them that way.
Yeah. So you have the California that's only 10 miles away, commanded by Captain Lord. And the California had turned off her engines because it had hit the ice field that night. And so we're just floating there. And the wireless man has taken off his set and gone to bed. Okay, Captain Lord is very imperious. His word is law. And so his officers see this strange ship on the horizon. And they remark to Captain Lord and say, you know, that looks like Titanic. And he says, no, that's not. Even though he asks his wireless man, any ships in the area? And he says, it's Titanic. Now, on the Titanic, Captain Smith and others can see the California, and they tell people getting into the boats, see that light? See that light? Row toward it. They'll pick you up. And this is backed up by lots of accounts. You got Jack Thayer's account, Lawrence Beasley's account. These are just a couple of survivors, but of the officers, everybody saw this light clearly, so clearly that people in the lifeboat started rowing toward it. But on the California, Captain Lord maintains that that's not the Titanic, and even when his officers see the ship shooting off rockets, because Lord goes to bed, and his officers are up there on the bridge, they're watching, and all of a sudden they see these rockets go off. So they call up Lord, and they say, there's rockets going off now. He says, what color are the rockets? They say they're white. He says, well, let me know if anything changes. Well, that's a ridiculous question, he asks, because any rockets mean one thing at sea, distress. Come quickly.
Yeah. There are a couple of heroes that we previously have not known about, and as a radio guy, I have to tell you, one of the things that I do when I'm not at the radio station is I teach the history of broadcast to students at Troy University. And they all know about Marconi, and we've all heard David Sarnoff's version of the night that the Titanic went down, that he was the only guy that was on duty and everything. Never take the word of somebody who stands to gain by putting themselves as a hero. Sarnoff was not the only guy. But the heroes are the Marconi operators on the Titanic who stayed at their post as the water is practically rising enough in the booth that they're going to get electrocuted if they don't get out of there.
That's right. It's Jack Phillips, Harold Bride. Just so your listeners just sort of frame it up for them, this is sort of wireless telegraphy of sort of the early days of the PC computer in the early 80s.
Yeah.
A lot of people didn't understand it. New technology, had its own language. 99% of the people did not know Morse code. So on Titanic, these two 20-something young guys, they didn't even work for White Star. They work for Marconi. So this is sort of regarded as strange. The captains don't really take the technology seriously. They think of it as more of a plaything for the first class to send off telegrams to New York and say, hey, we're on our way. And in truth, that's where Marconi made his money, was sending all these telegrams for the passengers. Now, ice warnings are coming in. They are being taken up to the bridge. But the ice warnings are not really regarded as that important. It's sort of like that gadget. That gadget is bringing in ice warnings. Okay, but you know what? I'm a captain of 30 years, Captain Smith. I know better. This newfangled thing, okay, fine. It said there's some ice here, but, I've been fine without it for all these years. I'll be fine, And also, the reason, they didn't like it was because before, the captain's word was law. Now there's this outside influence coming in saying, you should change your course and this and that. But you're right. They were the heroes because they stayed. Even after Captain Smith came down there at 2 a.m. and Titanic sinks at 2:20 and says, you've done your pit. It's every man for himself. Even then they didn't leave. They didn't leave until the power blinked out when Titanic was literally going down.
One of them survives. And we have his story. And he looks the rest of the night for his friend and realizes eventually that he didn't make it.
Right.
But these guys, it is amazing. And the fact that a lot has been said through the years about how massive the Titanic was, and it truly was, and how it had the best of everything. I never knew until I read your book that it had the best Marconi setup ever put on a ship up to that time, that the range at night, because the ionosphere dips down and you get a nice bounce, it had 2,000-mile range, which means there were people on either side of the Atlantic that are able to hear this distress signal. If they listen really closely, it'll go that far, which is just astonishing.
During the day, as you say, it's only about 250, 500 miles, but at night, up to 2,000. Well, so a lot of the messages were sent at night, and as you say, and this is in my book, these signals go bouncing into North America, and a lot of young men had picked up wireless telegraphy as a hobby.
Right.
Sets weren't expensive. You could string a wire across your roof, start picking up things. A lot like shortwave operators, you know?
Right.
And so there's four young guys in New Jersey who had, you know, their parents had gone to bed. They're all clustered around the set down in the kitchen. It's a rainy night. You know, the Model T's parked outside. And all of a sudden, they start picking up these signals from Titanic saying, you know, CQD, come quick distress, giving the longitude, latitude, and, you know, struck a berg, you know, putting off women and children in the boat. So, you know, they run up and tell their parents, and the parents simply don't believe them.
Right.
They're like, this is an unsinkable ship. You've got it wrong. But this is the incredible thing about this technology is how misunderstood it was. And, of course, David Sarnoff picks up a signal, too, and others. But, you know, it's sort of like the early days of the telephone where it's a party line. Everybody's on it.
Right.
Right? So you don't know when you're transmitting who's going to get it. All Jack Phillips and Harold Bride could do, the Marconi operators, is send out as many signals as they could.
Right.
Just repeat, and hope some ship close enough would pick it up.
As far as we know, there were lots of ships that picked up the signal. It seems like at some point you said there were 9 ships that were all in the vicinity, 2 of which
right.
did not actually help. But the others, they're zooming from a long way off to render whatever help they can. That the phrase unsinkable comes up so many times in this story because people are just sure that it can't really have sunk. That they had all this new technology and this new design, and certainly it's not sinking. People must be confused or they're playing a bad prank or something. That seems to contribute to, in part, some of the absolute refusal of people to accept the truth as it's being presented to them, that, by golly, it just sank.
So the whole unsinkable mantra comes from the fact that there's watertight bulkheads. This is big-time technology. And they're electric, all right? So Titanic hits something, you press the button on the bridge, all these, you know, big steel doors slam shut, and, you know, in theory, the ship can flood, but it'll all be contained in one part. Now, the problem is two things. One, Titanic turned from the iceberg instead of hitting straight on, which she would not have sunk if she had.
Right.
But, and so it rips along 5 compartments. Now, Titanic's bulkheads don't go all the way through the ship. They go up to about E deck. So think of it this way. As Titanic goes in, the first four compartments flood, and she would have been okay then, but 5 flood. Now there's so much, you know, 39,000 tons of water's come in. It starts pulling down the front of Titanic, sort of like a canoe with a heavy anchor thrown in the
mm-hmm.
front.
Mm-hmm.
So the bow's dipping down. The water comes in, fills up one compartment, floods up over E deck, and then goes over the top and fills up another. Now, at 4 compartments, the angle wouldn't be such that it would fill 5. But at 5, it keeps going down. The math is permanently skewed. It'd be like this. If you're sitting in your living room, and your bedroom fills up with water from a storm, and you think, well, I'm fine sitting in my living room. I've got the door shut. Well, the water eventually comes up and over the ceiling and pours down on you. Or think of, you know, water going upstairs. That's what happened to Titanic. And that's why, yes, she was unsinkable if 4 compartments got flooded, but once 5 were flooded, she was doomed.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, it was even Captain Smith, you know, we hear a lot about Captain Smith. He was a duck head on the head. He didn't understand why this ship was going to go to the bottom. I mean, when the architect Andrews told him, you know, she's going to founder. You have maybe 2 hours. He almost couldn't believe it. And so there was this hesitancy to unload the, you know, to uncover the lifeboats, to get people into lifeboats. And then the people didn't believe it. So they were hesitant to get in the lifeboats. And certainly people finding out about it were like, well, that can't be true. That's an unsinkable ship.
We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to William Hazelgrove, the author of 160 Minutes, The Race to Save the RMS Titanic. It's from Prometheus Books. Now, here's something else interesting, too. This is, which I had never known until I read your book, that the ship itself is being managed by the White Star Line, but it's not a possession of White Star. It actually belongs to an American investor. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, actually, J.P. Morgan owns it. There was all these after-the-fact theories of, you know, that it was this American ship, and, you know, J.P. Morgan had something to do with it. In terms of day-to-day operation, White Star was independent and, you know, ran the line.
Right.
Now, when Titanic sunk, Bruce Ismay, who famously was on the ship and was the director of White Star and jumped into a lifeboat, he wanted to get right on the ship and go back to Britain. He did not want to be pulled into an American inquiry, but he was. And this is the inquiry that was also pulling Stanley Lord, Captain Lord, from the California, and would basically convict him and say he was guilty of not coming to the aid of the Titanic when his ship was only 10 miles away.
That is one of the saddest parts of the book, is realizing that they could see the lights of the other ship that's just 10 miles away. This is another thing about this. Recently, I interviewed a guy who wrote a book about a prop plane that ditched in the North Atlantic in 1962 during basically almost a hurricane. This is completely different. There's no wave action. It's the sea is so still that one of the things that happens is they're not really sure if it's ice or if it's just the stars reflecting off this incredibly beautiful night.
Right.
It's not as though that everybody was in danger of the lifeboats flipping over because of the rough seas or anything like that. Basically, they're just sitting still. One guy even has the presence of mind to pull out something that was on all of the lifeboats, and that was a little mast and sail, because this guy is a vice president of a yachting association or something, so he just puts the sail up, and they're off to go. That was pretty incredible.
Yeah, you know, and that's sort of the third part of the rescue operation. So what they did is they put the first class in, basically, into the boat, into these lifeboats. It could hold 75 people, really, per boat. Unfortunately, they only half-filled them, or even less than half. So one boat had 10 people in it. And this was due to a couple things. One, they never had a lifeboat drill. A lot of the crew didn't even know how to lower the lifeboats, really. Two, this was the first class. There was this sort of bowing to them and scraping, you know, as they got in. You don't want to jam them all in there. And three, the thought was, well, maybe this could be just some sort of elaborate drill. We'll be coming back. Titanic may not really sink. But the upshot of it was there was, you know, 700 people in boats that could hold 1,175. Now, Titanic sinks, and all 1,521 people are in the water drowning. But they aren't drowning, they're freezing to death, basically.
Yeah.
And the people sitting around in those 20 boats have to listen to them. And, you know, their recollections are very eerie of what it sounded like. One person said it sounded like locusts on a summer night. Another person said it sounded like when the ball gets hit and the crowd cheers and roars. Another person said, though, and this has kind of been backed up by a lot of survivors, was that it was just one long death moan at the same pitch. Mm. So, you know, this is a very horrible moment, but what's more horrible is that only one boat went back.
Yeah.
And they were really too late when they did go back. The rest of them stayed off because they were afraid they would get swamped by the people. And there were people in the boats that said, we got to go back. But then other people said, no, we'll get swamped. So, again, we go back to the mythology of Titanic as one of heroism. But in fact, there are these dark moments where, you know, the human character was found wanting, and human failing was more the order of the night, because between the captains who would not go into the ice field, risk their own ship to rescue Titanic, and the people who would not go back, it is not the same narrative that we've seen in the movies and in the stories.
Right.
It's really more of a narrative of a lot of people coming up short and a few people being heroic.
Yeah, yeah. Once again, I keep going back to those two young Marconi operators risking their lives, in one case giving his life, and the other one being seriously disadvantaged, shall we say, by eventually getting out onto one of the last lifeboats, the one with collapsible sides, but his feet dangle in the water. So by the time he gets rescued, he's suffering from severe frostbite because the temperature, even though it's April, the temperature is below freezing or close to freezing enough that it's going to damage the people. And that's why so many of the people that actually got out of the ship still died. They just floated until they froze to death.
That's right. So Harold Bride is the surviving Marconi operator, and he's telling everybody he's actually on an overturned boat. He's just laying there with his feet in the water, as you say. And he's telling people, you know, a ship is coming, Carpathia. Now, the Carpathia is commanded by Captain Rostrum. He is, you know, sort of the model of the way you want people to act.
Yeah.
He got his lifeboats out. He put all the steam in his ship into his engines, took all the heat away from the passengers. He set up a makeshift hospital. He put on extra light lookouts, and then he turned his ship around and went full bore, full steam toward Titanic. He's 50 miles away, dodging icebergs as he went, and with no regard in terms of, you know, his own safety. He just was like, we've got to get there and save Titanic if we can. And, of course, he'll get there an hour late. He'll get there at about 3:20 or 3:30. And, you know, but that's the only rescue operation that was successful. That yeah. was the rescue when he pulled the 700 people out of the water. But without, as you say, the Marconi operators, Jack Phillips, Harold Bride, if they hadn't sent those signals, we today would not know what happened to Titanic.
I'm reminded of two other disasters at sea that had very different endings than Titanic. You mentioned a couple of others in the book that I had not heard of, but one of them is the Birkenhead, which was a military ship that went down probably 50 or 60 years before this, and they were all British soldiers in one of the Scottish regiments, and they put all the women and children on the lifeboats, and as the ship was going down, the pipers were piping, and the sharks were circling, and it was a big deal at the time, but you never hear of it anymore. And the other is the Andrea Doria that went down 40 years after the Titanic, and everybody gets saved. And the difference is probably the technology, but also the willingness of people to jump in there and save people.
And that's the thing. Up to Titanic, people didn't regard, and this seems incredible to us, wireless technology is a great safety device, as something that could save a ship, even though, you know, the first thing Smith did, Captain Smith did, was he went down to the wireless room and said, send, you know, CQD.
Yeah.
And he gave them the longitude and latitude. And, you know, he knew right away at that moment that the two wireless operators were their only chance.
Yeah.
But that this was their only chance to save the ship. And so, you know, it's too bad he didn't understand that before, because, you know, he was going full steam into that ice field. And, of course, we've heard a lot of, you know, theories on this. But probably the truth is, you know, he had Bruce Ismay on board, and he wanted to set a record. You know, he was his last voyage.
Sure.
He was going to retire. This was Titanic. And, you know, there's this thought, it seems incredible to us now, that the best way to get through ice was to go full bore, go full steam.
Right.
And get through as quickly as you could. But, of course, this set him up to, you know, hit this iceberg. And, you know, and again, it was a sort of perfect storm where it opened up. The one they found out after 1985 when they went down, there's six slits along the Titanic. And those six slits were the reason she sank.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just never a good idea to have in your press releases things like, this is a ship that God can't sink. I'm just thinking that's not a very smart thing to even get about. The people that were rescued, there were people that were traumatized for the rest of their lives. But there were others that went on to tell their stories. And there is kind of an interesting side light that Marconi tells his surviving operator, don't talk to anybody. Don't tell anybody anything. I've got an exclusive interview set up for you, and you'll make a lot of money. which I think kind of interesting.
So what happens is, so they all get on Carpathia, and the whole world wants to know what happened. So Harold Cotton is the wireless operator on the Carpathia, but he's exhausted because now he has to start sending all these lists of people who survived.
Right.
And so he literally collapses. Now, again, as we said before, wireless telegraphy was unknown to 99% of the people. They didn't understand it. They understand Morse code. There was continental Morse, all sorts of different kinds. So they have to get Harold Bride, who's actually recovering on Carpathia with his, severely frostbitten feet. They have to get him up and say, "Can you take over?" And he does. So this guy who went down with Titanic ends up back at the telegraph key, sending out messages, and he's getting all these inquiries. Some of them are from the president asking, what happened, who survived. And he gets a message from Guglielmo Marconi saying, "Listen, keep your mouth shut.
Yeah,
I've set up a deal with the New York Times, and you'll get $1,000 for it." Now, I opened my book with that chapter of Marconi waiting for the ship to arrive, wireless telegraphy officer Harold Bide on board, and he immediately runs to the room, the wireless room, and, Bride is still sending out messages. He goes, "You don't have to do that anymore." Takes him from there to a hotel room where he sits him down with the New York Times. This was the guy that everybody wanted to talk to. When Carpathia came back to New York, all these ships met her with all these reporters, and they were literally throwing money onto the deck of the ship, telling survivors, "Jump overboard, and we'll pay you for your story." They were just desperate to know. But Harold Bride was really the guy everybody wanted to talk to. So he gives his story to the New York Times. And the New York Times, we're used to it being this top paper. At the time, it wasn't. It's just another paper.
Right.
But because they get this great scoop, they plaster his story all over the place. And that really is the first time people learn what actually happened to Titanic, was from Harold Bride, the wireless operator.
It is really a fascinating new look at a terrible tragedy almost 110 years ago. So much new information that you have in this book that has never been released before, and the way that you've written it is just a gripping narrative. So, Will, do you want to tell people your website or website for the book?
Sure. You can go to williamhazelgrove.com to get more information on Titanic. There's some interviews there. And also, you can get the book just anywhere, Barnes & Noble or Amazon.com, or just put in my name or 160 Minutes, The Race to Rescue the Titanic, and you can pick it up.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being with us again. You've got another book coming out pretty soon, I know. And when that comes out, I'm looking forward very much to getting a chance to talk to you again. Thanks for always making time to talk to me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Our thanks once again to Will Hazelgrove, the author of 160 Minutes, The Race to Save the RMS Titanic, from Prometheus Books, an imprint of Roman and Littlefield Publishing Group, Inc. Once again, you can go to his website, williamhazelgrove.com, or just Google Titanic, and you'll be able to find it easily enough. Absolutely fascinating story. Thanks so much for joining us today. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and podcast. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Dockert. Thanks for listening, and God bless.